Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you saw so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government?
Debt, gum, government. Man, I think we'll be talking a little bit about that tonight. Welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman, Mike Getty, and Tenacity, yours truly, Terry Dodd. Tonight's discussion should be quite interesting. Mike, how you doing today, my friend?
I'm coming right along, Terry. I hope you're well.
I'm doing pretty good. I'm staying busy and looking forward to hoping things are going to slow down a little bit here coming into these holidays. I know a lot of the world out there is wanting to get reopened, but I haven't really slowed down. So I guess I'm not exactly feeling the pain of what's here and what's coming for a lot of people. Well, before we start, things are going well for you. Yep. Things good in your territory?
I have no reason to complain. I'm just sitting around watching the world go back.
Yeah, that it is. Speaking of that, I think we better open this with a prayer.
Please do.
Got a feeling we're going to need some protection tonight. Almighty Father, we just come before you humbly. We look at your creation and we're in awe. Your majesty is beyond our imagination. Your understanding is so perfect, and we look forward to the day when we can have a direct audience with you and you can answer some of the questions that we have in our mind. Father, we know we need you in our life. We know that we will beat our heads against the wall if we go out and try to do anything without you, without your spirit going before us. It's really humbling when we think about your son and the way that you paid the price for us to be able to have an audience with you and for you to be able to sustain us. So we invite your control here with Handling the Truth. We invite you to take control of our words, our statements, open our eyes, remove the scales from Mike's eyes, my eyes, and our listeners' eyes tonight. So please give us a protection, a guard against all the evil that is surrounding us. It's in the name of your Son, our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike,
amen.
you've thrown out this this article about Boot. And I'm anxious to see where you start this conversation out, because it could go a lot of different ways. And I'm just going to sit back for a minute here and let you introduce this subject.
Terry, in the interest of full disclosure, I think I should tell everyone that I believe that all of the drama that we're watching was pre-planned, several years back, and it the parts of it have been put together. And we're, no matter which side of the aisle you find yourself on, and I don't think there would probably be too many liberals listening to us, but no matter which side of the aisle you find yourself on and where your sentiments lie, I know it's going to be hard to accept, but all we're living and watching a play that's been rehearsed and been practiced over and over. And I believe there is an end result. I would like to know which way they plan to go with this. But I see so many things that make me think this was planned. And before I get to Max Boot and his article, I would like to relate. I've had several conversations in the past week with a former Arkansas state senator. And, Terry, I'm hoping that I can get him on our program. I had him scheduled to be on my program last Sunday, and unfortunately he had a family event and he couldn't make it. But I sat and watched the legislature in Arkansas in the session in 2017. I watched the Senate especially, and I began to watch this man who made more sense than any other politician I saw that was there. And, I don't mind telling you his name. His name is Brian King. And I watched him with a lot of interest because when you heard the debates, you heard the things that were being said, I was especially, intrigued by this man. And so one day in the corridors around the Senate chambers, during a recess or, a break for whatever, I walked up to him and I said, introduced myself. And I said, Senator, I said, I hope you don't mind. I've got a question for you. And he said, what's that? And I said, well, what is your opinion? Because the Arkansas legislature now has a super majority of Republicans and in both houses. And the governor is a Republican and the attorney general is a Republican. Of course, the lieutenant governor is a Republican. I said, this is a Republican-dominated state. And I said, how do you think plays out from your point of view as a senator? And I was a little bit taken aback. He said, I believe that this supermajority of Republicans in this state is probably the worst thing that has happened to the people of Arkansas since Reconstruction. And I guess I stood there for a second, here's a Republican senator saying this. And I said, how so? And he said, well, we probably would be better to talk about that at another time or location. But he said, right now I've got to get back into the chambers. So over the years, since 2017, I've talked with Brian on quite a few occasions. But I remember attending a dinner in Little Rock in late fall of 2017, where he was honored as the senator from the state of Arkansas who voted most clearly with the Constitution. And he had the best rating of voting with the Constitution and followed close behind by a lady, God rest her soul, Linda Collins Smith. And I got to know both of them and talk with them extensively, many times on the phone at nighttime and other things when we would talk about constitutional issues as it related to bills that were before the Senate. And but at this dinner, he was honored, and so was Linda Collins Smith. And then there were two members of the House of Representatives who were also given awards for voting most closely with the Constitution. And I was not a bit surprised in 2018 when the Republican Party of the state of Arkansas, and especially the governor, tirelessly to make sure these two senators were defeated. Now, and I'm sure there are people who would say, well, how does that work? Well, you would have to understand Arkansas politics. But anyway, they lost in 2018, and there was no lack of effort on the part of the Republican Party itself. And I was amazed at the time that a party that said that they were for the Constitution, for limited government and everything else, went after the two Senate members who were so much involved and were so closely adhering to the Constitution. Fortunately, Linda Collins Smith was murdered, something over a year ago. And so that is still, in my mind, a very questionable circumstance. But I was talking with Brian about this election, and I'm finally getting to the point, I guess. And I was talking to him about this election, and he said, well, I can tell you, as an experienced politician, every election is fraudulent in some way, shape, form, or fashion at some place. He said every election I was ever involved in my time in running in both as a member of the House and as a senator, he said every election I was involved in Arkansas was corrupt. And he said, I think that would be true all over the country. He said, it's just the degree of corruption. And so when we were talking last Sunday afternoon, he said, we were talking about the fiasco that's going on in this country now. And he said, but when it is this obvious, there's a reason for it. He said, there are many elections, and he and I both discussed the election in 1960 of John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Richard Nixon. And it was, if you go back and do your research, you will find out that Richard Nixon won that election. John Kennedy actually ended up being president because of a huge, massive voter fraud in the state of Illinois, masterminded by Richard Daley in the Chicago area and some other folks. But then the story was, or as I was told when I had access to powers that be in Washington, the story that I was told was that Nixon was told, shut up, don't do any complaining, and your time will come. If you make an issue out of this, then your political career is over. So what that tells me, Terry, is that things have been manipulated for a long time. And I had really not thought of it until Brian told me that, hey, every election is corrupt. Every election has fraud in it one way or another. And, of course, he and I did a lot of discussion on different campaigns he was involved in, but that won't serve any purpose here. But perhaps if we can get him on the show sometime, that would be very entertaining and enlightening. But now to get to Max Boot. Max Boot was John McCain's foreign policy advisor. And as I told you earlier in a little conversation we had, Max Boot made John McCain look like George McGovern when it came to war. Max Boot was a wild, guy. He was a member of the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, still is. And he is now he speaks on MSNBC and he writes for the Washington Post. Well, when I was in Washington, we referred to the Washington Post as the Pravda on the Potomac. So I found it unusual when I started looking into certain aspects of this was that on July the 6th, and I think I sent you the article, Terry, on July the 6th, Max Boot wrote an article, and the title of the article was "What If Trump Loses But Refuses to Leave Office?" And I thought, that's a strange article for anyone to be writing, several months before the election, 4 or 5 months before the election. I thought that was unusual that he wrote that. But then when I got into the article, and he said they had actually had some focus groups that had been working on the various scenarios for the election. What if this happens? What if that happens? The question immediately went to mind, why? Why in July or prior to July, because he wrote the article in July the 6th, sometime prior to that, they had had focus groups doing planned elections and going through different scenarios. What if this happens? What if that happens? What if the other happens? So my immediate question was, to what end? And Boot was involved in these, which meant to me, without any shadow of a doubt, that the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a globalist organization. So I was wondering, why were they running different scenarios? Well, one thing that I knew from my intelligence days, and I'm not saying my intelligence, but in the intelligence field, during that time, the thing that I know was when I watched the planning on so many occasions of the manipulation and the takeover of elections in Central and South America and even in the Middle East. And I was just wondering, have we used the exact same dynamic in this election? And did they make the fraud so obvious to everyone? As other words, you know, I think I said today somewhere that this election, the fraud of this election would have been obvious to Ray Charles. It's so blatant in so many ways. So the other thing I wanted to ask, Terry, which has stuck in my mind as I've been going through various scenarios, please help me. I have forgotten. What was the attorney's name that we had on the program that was involved in the lawsuit against Obama?
Mario Puzo.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. But if you will remember our show, and, you know, I had some questions about this for him. I, you know, a very intelligent man. I really enjoyed that program. When I asked him, he said that when he sued or filed a lawsuit to claim that Obama was not a natural-born citizen, that he was told by the federal court that he had no standing. And I said, you mean as an attorney you had no standing? If you remember this differently, Terry, please tell me. I said, as an attorney you had no standing. And then you said that your client, who I believe was a retired colonel, that he had no standing also, that the court ruled he had no standing. And I remember asking the good counselor, well, then did you find out who would have standing? And he said, well, according to what I was told, the only person who would have standing in a court in a lawsuit over an election would be a candidate. And if I remember correctly, I said, are you telling me that the voters, the people who are involved in the outcome of the election, have no standing? And he said, well, that was the court's ruling. So now as I'm looking at that and I'm looking at some of these lawsuits, especially in Georgia, there are several lawsuits in Georgia that have been filed by the people themselves. And I understand there's similar lawsuits in both Michigan and Pennsylvania at this time that have been filed by the voters who experienced voter fraud, either witnessed it or or saw it perpetrated before their eyes and filed lawsuits. Is the federal courts going to rule in those cases? Are they going to stay with precedent and rule that the voters have no standing in an election? What are your thoughts?
Well, there was another attorney, and I'm sorry I don't have his name fresh in my mind, that actually had a candidate as a client and included a candidate in the lawsuit. Similar lawsuit filed in a different state as the one Puzo did with retired Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kirshner. Was it a Ford or trying to remember the guy's name? It might have been Booth or Ford. I don't remember, but the courts didn't hear that case either. So it doesn't really matter who's filing it if the courts want to say you don't have standing. What they look for, or they claim they're looking for, is that someone is uniquely injured by it. In other words, if your injury is just like everybody else's injury, they justify saying no standing. So that's why in the case of the voters, well, just one voter, well, you're no different than this other voter, so you don't have standing. I mean, to me, it's ludicrous because, you know, it's a complete violation. To me, it renders the courts useless except as tools of tyranny, because if they're not going to hear a case to determine who was injured in something, what good are they?
Well, you know, Terry, in the case like in Georgia where there are multiple people involved in a lawsuit, there is, then you can see them right away be saying you don't have any standing because there's nothing unique about a group. But here is the point again, and you and I spoke about this earlier, and I watched and listened to a YouTube today of Larry Klayman, and for folks who don't know, he was the founder of Judicial Watch. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then he's been involved in multitudinous lawsuits against the government in many instances. But today I heard Larry Klayman say, and if I'm not mistaken, he has written a book on this subject called Revolution. And he specifically stated today that the court system in this country is so corrupt that there's no way to salvage it. And he said that the judicial branch of this government is more corrupt than either the executive or the legislative branch. And they have much more control, which I totally agree with, because they can overrule the president or the Congress at their whim. And he went into detail on some of the justices on the Supreme Court, and he was not flattering in any respect. And I found this a bit unusual coming from an attorney at this point and with all that's happening. And he basically said today that if the Trump supporters are depending on an honest shake from the Supreme Court, that it's a pipe dream. So I have been amazed, and as I told you earlier, I have been telling people for 20 years or writing can't be fixed. And I said that 20 years ago. So, and I said that before 9/11, that, well, basically I said that after the Oklahoma City bombing, that it was so corrupt, there was no way to fix it. And one of the reasons I said that at the time when I saw what happened to the federal grand jury that was allegedly investigating the Oklahoma City bombing and Happy Hapsburg. Do you remember him, Terry?
Yes.
Well, he was selected for the grand jury. For the people who aren't aware of this, I don't mean to be redundant, but he was selected for the grand jury, and he studied up. He found out. He did some research when he knew he was going to be on this, and he found out about jury nullification. And he also found out the role of a grand jury. So as I heard the story, and the gentleman who told me the story was a reporter, and he has now passed away. But he told me the story that Happy Hapsburg goes in and sits down, and after they go through a couple of hours of briefing or what have you, he tells the federal prosecutor, he says, well, sir, he says, you can leave now. And he said, no, he says, I'm directing this grand jury. And he said, no, sir, that is not your role. You are not to direct the grand jury. That the grand jury is to do an independent investigation without your control. And the next day, the federal judge relieves Happy Hapsburg from his position on the grand jury. Well, having had a similar experience prior to that in Tucson, Arizona, I realized then that the system was gone because it had been completely and totally removed from any effect or power from the people. And if they can control a grand jury like they did in Ferguson, Missouri. Now, I'm not going to take a side on whether the police officer killed the black gentleman in there, whether he killed him without provocation or whatever happened. I'm not going to address that. What I'm going to address is the grand jury. Is the district attorney in Ferguson, Missouri, ran the grand jury, and he even brought in exculpatory witnesses and even brought in the police officer, and they interviewed him for several hours. That is totally wrong. It's totally unconstitutional. But there is, to be rather emphatic, Terry, I'm not sure there is anything constitutional at all about this government anymore. At any phase, I do not believe there's anything that is constitutional. But if we go by what the Supreme Court said in McCulloch v. Maryland, there is nothing that the Congress can do that is unconstitutional. Because according to that ruling in 1819, I believe it was, and John Marshall gave the majority opinion, and he wrote the majority opinion, was that the government has extra powers that aren't listed, that their powers do not have to be listed, and that they can do basically whatever they want to do under the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Supremacy Clause. So no matter how you want to argue it or whatever you want to say, if the Congress claims that it was necessary and proper, they can do anything they want to. And the courts have the precedent from 1819, you know, what, 200 years ago. They have the precedent to say, yes, whatever whatever it does. And you and I have discussed, Terry, on multiple occasions, what Patrick Henry said at the Virginia Ratification Convention is the fact that there is no recourse. The people have no recourse. You have a right to petition for grievances. In other words, you can say, hey, that is unconstitutional, but they don't have to rule on it. And they can continue to do whatever they want to. And this system, my opinion, and I sell it for what it's worth, has been broken since basically its inception. It's been broken and manipulated. And if you go back, and also, and I did this today, no one hated the judicial branch more than Thomas Jefferson. And he tried and tried.
Maybe Red Beckman did.
Yeah. That is probably a fact, but Jefferson outlined and said what the, you know, he called the court, the federal courts, a group of sappers and miners working day and night to undermine the very fabric of the Constitution. And he said that in, what, 1818-something, almost 200 years ago. And, you know, I was talking to someone, look at the decisions that the Supreme Court has made. You know, the Supreme Court said slavery was legal. The Supreme Court said that we could take a people who haven't violated any laws whatsoever and put them in internment camps. Folks, that may be coming pretty soon, too, again. But the Supreme Court in Korematsu versus U.S. said that you can take people just because somebody might be afraid of them, you can take them all and put them in concentration camps. They just go from, okay, we're worried because you're a Japanese American, we're worried you might do something, extrapolate that to, oh, we're worried that you might infect other people with COVID-19, so we're going to isolate you in a concentration facility. And I know there's a bunch of people out there saying, oh, that'll never happen. Well, you know, if you read if you read what the Germans said in 1933 to 1945, you will understand they didn't think it would happen either. So what are your thoughts so far, Terry? What are you thinking?
Wow. Well, you went to the COVID thing, so my mind wandered, I'm afraid. I'm aware right now of a assisted living and a memory care unit right here in our town that's been testing for COVID. Well, they've now basically quarantined the vast majority of their staff and have no one remaining to fill the duties to maintain the place. And the people didn't have symptoms. They mandatorily tested them. So if that's happening all across the United States or globe, there's no way that economically or functionally or any other way that things are going to be able to continue to function on any kind of semblance of normality. And as far as the judiciary is concerned, I've been totally convinced that the judiciary is vastly corrupt. And it's like Red always said, they are beneficiaries of the tax system, and the tax system's unconstitutional. So, you know, they're incapable of making an impartial determination of law or finding a fact. And they're all sold out. They're sold out to their pension plans. They're beneficiaries of an unconstitutional tax system. So how in the world could it in any way semblance be fair or impartial? Can't. It's impossible. Is that what you were looking for? Did you mute yourself? Did I lose you, Mike?
Well, there it is. Muted myself, and then I couldn't get back to it. What I was asking was, how is the tax system unconstitutional? I agree with everything but that. So tell me how the tax system is unconstitutional.
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court said it. I'm not just making it up in my own opinion. In 1896, the court rendered the income tax legislation that was passed in 1895. They stated that it was unconstitutional because it was a direct tax and it was not apportioned. And in that alone, it is not constitutional, because the Constitution expressly prohibits that. And the system we have today is a direct non-apportioned tax.
Well, you're going to have to help me again here. You can be my teacher. Where in the Constitution does it say a direct tax is unconstitutional?
Well, it dictates that no direct non-apportioned tax. I mean, let me go grab a copy of it and look it up. If you want to keep talking, I'll give you an explicit answer to that one, because the language is right there.
I will, but I know that the word apportioned is there, but I am, help me out with that word direct, because I do know that the every state sent in a proposed amendment to the Constitution that there be no direct taxes placed on the people. And that constitutional amendment was rejected, and I am familiar with several arguments in that first Congress about a direct taxation being unconstitutional, but they about them wanting it to be unconstitutional, but no such amendment was ever added. And there is nothing in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 that says anything about any limits on taxation, either amounts or avenues of taxation. So help me with that. I want to be educated on that point.
Read through and pick it out, but
well, that is just because I know that Thomas Tudor Tucker of South Carolina tried to bring back into that first Congress. He tried to reinstitute the amendment that would ban any direct taxation on the people, and James Madison shot it down. I don't know what you got with that read back there, buddy, but it's pretty good.
I'm sorry. I went to grab something and got away from my Bluetooth on the computer. Okay, this is in. I'm sure it's Article 1. I'm trying to see which section it is. Well, I'll just read the paragraph. No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration hereinbefore directed to be taken. And in the decision of the Supreme Court in 1896, they specifically said that this progressive income tax was a direct tax, and it was non-apportioned, and as a result of that, it was unconstitutional, and what I just read you was the basis of that decision.
Okay, well, I agree with that. I'm familiar with them saying that, but and I know it was definitely not apportioned according to population. That is absolutely true. But, then I agree that according to that Constitution. But then of course, they also said the 16th Amendment did not grant any new taxing powers, too, didn't they?
They did. They said that it conveyed no new taxing authority or power.
But it did.
It bluffed. It was a bluff.
Yeah. So we can't trust. We can't trust the Supreme Court. Is that what you're telling me, Terry?
Well, in 1896, I think they made a proper decision.
That's intriguing in itself that they. But did they not, on multiple occasions after the Civil War or the Law of Northern Aggression, did they not, on several occasions, rule a direct tax, capitation tax on the people to be unconstitutional? Did they not do that more than once?
Well, in that case where they, after the 16th Amendment, when they said that was another example of them agreeing with the 1896 decision. I don't have a list of those decisions. So.
I remember a long conversation that you and I had. I remember exactly where I was sitting in Arkansas, a long conversation. And if I'm not mistaken, it's the very last time that I was privileged to talk with Red Beckman. But if I remember correctly, we talked on the phone for way over an hour. And we talked about his experiences taking a case to the Supreme Court. Do you remember that?
Yes. It's still docketed.
And yes, and they won't hear it either. They will never hear that case.
Correct.
And his points were well made in that case no federal judge could actually sit, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but no federal judge could sit in judgment of a case involving the government because it constituted a conflict of interest.
Right. That's what I was just saying, that they are they are beneficiaries of the government tax system. And as a result of that, they cannot make an impartial decision related to that.
And that, I believe, but here's the point, is the fact that the Supreme Court's never going to hear that case. And they would never hear another case brought on the same grounds.
No, it would allow the 10,000 certified documents that he paid Bill Benson to go out to the 48 states and collect on a certified basis. See, when he first took the case before the courts, all the documents were not certified. So they basically would not allow them to be entered into the court record unless they were certified. So he sent Benson back out to the states and obtained certified documents. And then after that, every case that was offered as evidence got dismissed, so that evidence would never enter into an official court record.
Well, didn't Benson have his record seized by a federal judge in Chicago? And wasn't Bill Benson charged with attempting to avoid the income tax with his case?
Yes. Yeah, he was.
Well,
but Red had copies of all of that.
Right, I realize
they didn't get the records.
Right, but the judge ordered him seized what he had with him at that time, and charged him with tax evasion. And I'm really not sure how a judge can file an indictment against anybody.
Right.
But they
not
sure
only
did,
that,
they
if
sure
you look at it. If you look at if we look at the others, and you've brought this out, you've brought out a number of cases where when someone refused to pay what they thought was an unfair or unconstitutional tax, in many cases they were charged with treason.
Yes. And that is true, and they have done that on multiple occasions. And see, this is why, and I've got this fisheye look from hundreds of people over the years, but this is why I've told people that this system was corrupt from the starting gate. And one of the first things, and there are several letters among the founders that prove this, that they passed into the Constitution in 1787 what they felt like they could get the states to ratify, with the thoughts of completing their overall program in the first Congress. And that's exactly what they did. Because even Larry Clayman talked about this today, that Jefferson said that the entire Judicial Act of 1789 was unconstitutional, and it was. Because the Judicial Act of 1789, which is the first act out of Congress, a Federalist-controlled Congress, the very first act they passed, was totally unconstitutional because it amended the Constitution, totally amended Article 3 of the Constitution. And in several letters among the Federalists prior to this date, while the first session of Congress was in effect, especially when they talked about dealing with amendments, several of the members of Congress, in letters to each other or to constituents or to other people, said, look, we have to get these other measures done to complete our work before we deal with amendments. Samuel Bryan called the Constitutional Convention a criminal conspiracy. And I believe he was right on. I believe he nailed it totally because, no matter how you want to look at it, you can call them inspired by God all you want to. I'm just not sure who your God is. These men all exceeded the authority that was granted to them by their respective states. and two men, both of whom were justices on the New York Supreme Court. One of them became Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court, left the Constitutional Convention, and said that they left it for that very reason, that the delegates there, being fine, respectable men, I think they said, are still exceeding the authority granted to them by the people of the states they represent. And therefore, they said, and therefore we cannot be continue to be a part of this. Now, there were two men with integrity, and they left. The other man with super integrity was none other than Patrick Henry, and no one fought against ratification of the Constitution harder than Patrick Henry. And Luther Martin.
When I tell people that are awake, they their eyes get big and they go, really? Because it's been written out of history.
Yes. And you also have Luther Martin, who was probably the finest lawyer in the history of America, a cantankerous, drinking, hard drinking, you know, love to fight at the drop of a hat, a cantankerous old, as one guy said, a cantankerous old bastard. But he fought diligently for the rights of the people. 30-some years as an attorney general for the state of Maryland, he took everybody to task at the Constitutional Convention, left the Constitutional Convention, refused to sign the Constitution, and then went to the Maryland legislature and told them exactly what the people were doing at the Constitutional Convention, which they had all agreed to keep secret for 50 years.
So but he refused to take that oath after arriving late.
Well, no, he didn't refuse to take it. He wasn't there when they initially took the oath, because he arrived a little over a week late because of prosecuting a case in the Maryland courts. So he was a little late getting there, so he didn't
take the oath. They never asked him to take the oath?
I have read an account that they asked him, and he just said no. Now,
you know,
that could go either way. But either way, he revealed, and if you want to look it up on the Internet. It's called Genuine Information. He put together all of his stuff, all of his objections, everything that he did. And no one at that Constitutional Convention was more upset the fact that the Constitution itself embraced slavery. No one was more upset than Luther Martin. And he said it was a crime against heaven. And, you know, here was, you know, the old drinker, as they called him, you know, the guy who, you know, loved alcohol, who would fight harder against the Constitution point of view. And he fought ratification in Maryland as well. And this is the point I ask people all the time when I tell them the Constitution was crooked from the get-go. These are the people who get all upset, you know, and they do this. And I said, well, here's the one thing I want you to do. Explain for me Patrick Henry and Luther Martin. If you can explain away those two gentlemen, and they were on different ends of the spectrum, because all you have to do is to read Patrick Henry's will and read his other, you know, his professions of the Christian faith. And I can find nothing about that about Luther Martin. But those two gentlemen fought harder against ratification of the Constitution, along with Samuel Bryan, who did it in a written form. They fought harder against ratification of the Constitution than anyone. People say, well, I just don't agree with you. I'll say, well, prove them wrong, and I'll agree with you. Because if you look at the Virginia Ratification Convention and everything that Patrick Henry said would happen if this Constitution was ratified, it's eerie. It's like this guy had a vision into the future. Because he said this is what's going to happen, and it happened. And also, the gentleman who left the let me see, John Lansing Jr. and Robert Yates. Robert Yates wrote as Brutus, and read his. Those will just, he predicted everything the Supreme Court was going to do. And he was a member of the New York Supreme Court when he did it. And he said, this is what will happen with this Supreme Court under your Constitution. And he nailed it. How did,
here we are today with what remnants we have left of a republic are in those people's hands.
Right. But I don't think we've got any remnant left, to be honest with you. We've got a remnant of people. I don't think we have – I'm not sure.
Well, it's an illusion. It's an illusion, but it's the illusion is still there.
Well, you know, I've been in my – I've been talking about what is a Republican form of government. And, as you know, and this thing – everybody quotes to this quote by Benjamin Franklin, you've got a republic if you can keep it. Well, bull crap. They did not write a republic. That was not a Republican form of government. And the one thing we can say about the government, they are unconstitutional every day that they operate because of Article 4, Section 4. They have not provided every state in the union with a Republican form of government. It's just not there. There are seven qualities or seven qualifications to be a Republican government, Republican form of government, and we don't adhere to them. And that republic was an illusion. It's always been an illusion. The only thing that one could say was federal about that government that left in 1787, the only thing federal about that Constitution was the election of senators by the state legislatures. And then, of course, we destroyed that with the 17th Amendment. Yeah, but yep. The 17th wasn't ratified either.
No.
So we are controlled by three amendments in many ways, 14th, 16th, and the 17th. The people are controlled by three amendments that were never ratified according to the Constitution. And where are the people complaining about that?
Well, the ones that have been ignored.
Well, ignored or, you know, it's almost like being a whistleblower. You can't tell people that the government's corrupt. They get real upset with that. But one of the points I would like to make, again, Terry, to go back to this, is we know it's documented that in January of 2017, Dr. Fauci, you know, I call him, he looked like Himmler to me. But Dr. Fauci says that President Trump would face a mystery virus in 2020. Now, how did he know that? And then we've got Max Boot writing an article about, well, what if Trump loses the election but refuses to concede or refuses to leave?
Well, it's real simple. It's partially it's projection, but they also knew that they were going to cheat and prompt justified complaints about the election. So they had to cut off the defense of that in advance. So that's why you see this. They had to have knowledge. They had to have prior knowledge of exactly the type of corruption that we're witnessing.
Well, I call COVID fake. Now, I need to clarify that, as I realize that there is some form of influenza out there, but I do not believe it is near as dangerous or anything else as they say it is. I believe it may even be less dangerous than flus we've had in the past. But it has been propagandized, and it was intended to be propagandized for 2 points, because this creates the largest transfer of wealth in American history, this COVID madness. And also it precipitated this election, because without this need for mail-in ballots, we wouldn't be looking at all this fraud. This is why I think the whole thing was pre-planned. It was laid out. They put it through some focus groups to see how it would work. Boot writes about one of them after he's involved in it. And there is, in a PSYOP, what you do is you prepare the minds of the people to accept certain facts they normally wouldn't accept. And one of the ways you get people to accept those things is to mention it beforehand. I mean, guys, we can go all the way back to 2003 in a television episode of Law and Order. They had a mysterious virus called COVID in 2003 on Law and Order. The preparation, the mind preparation is done, and especially by the 24-hour news cycle. And the 24-hour news cycle has accomplished so many things, including the polarization of this country. Because for every since 2016, early 2017, when Trump took office, and I'm no Trump fan, but ever since he took office, the media has done nothing but one assault after another on him. I, too, believe that was planned. Because there is one way that you can get people to form a cult around their person, and that is to have everybody they hate demonize them on a daily basis. I was amazed I wasn't really amazed. I thought the figure might even be higher. But I read today that 28% of the people who support Trump say he could do nothing that would cause them to lose their faith in him. Nothing he could do. And earlier this week, I had a lady that I've known for years who told me straight up should be allowed to violate the Constitution in any way he wants to because the Democrats have done it before he did. A normally intelligent lady said that, and she believes it. And that, I believe, is programmed into this destruction. And I'm going to tell people what my thoughts are on this. And, you know, and I hope I'm wrong. I pray I'm wrong. And that is, if they flip this election and they say, okay, there was massive fraud and Trump won, then, in my opinion, what will happen, then we're going to see mass chaos in the cities, especially those controlled by left-wing governments. We're going to see massive revolts, massive violence. We're going to see all of this stuff, and it's going to come. And these people did not spend money militarizing Antifa and BLM for nothing. So what I see happening is then we have these massive revolts all over the country. We've got violence everywhere, and Trump declares martial law unconstitutionally, but the right supports him 100% because something's got to be done about these damn liberals. And so the right of this country will then assume the position that as long as their guy is in charge, the Constitution or any constitutional restraints are thrown out the window. And then I would not be at least bit surprised to see Trump call in the military, either ours or the UN, and the right would support him when he did that because they said, look, yes, it's unconstitutional. I heard this in Oregon and in Chicago. Yes, it's unconstitutional. We realize it's unconstitutional, but something has to be done about these liberals. The stage has been set for this. The right will accept it. Total, just taking all restrictions off whatsoever of any acts as long as it's their guy. And I believe these constant attacks on Trump by the left the all of the FBI scams, all of this other stuff. It's been instituted to create a cult of worship of a man so that the people will accept whatever he does. Hope I'm wrong. I pray I'm wrong, but I firmly believe that, Jerry.
Well, what's worse, letting them take us back into war and this supposed great reset of the banksters by acquiescing and just allowing them to take control? What's worse?
Terry, I don't think we can say what's worse because what's worse is going to be bad on the American people regardless of how it works. What would work is for someone to actually stand for what is right with the restraints that are there that have been abridged over and over and over again, but for someone to actually stand for what was right. I don't think we need to get into, well, who is the best of two evils. I don't think we need to go there.
But what's because right? I changed that. When you're fighting against unrestrained evil and corruption, what do you do to that's right? What can be right?
Well, being just as evil as they are is not an answer.
I'm not suggesting that, but what actions can be done that's right to correct the corruption? You're sitting there with a judiciary, with a court system, and with a Congress that are all completely corrupt and evil. So
well,
what's a recourse? What's a peaceful recourse?
I don't think there is a peaceful recourse. I pray I'm wrong, but I don't think there is a peaceful recourse. And here is the point. Here's the factor, again, that can say, okay, it's all right if my guy violates the rules as long as we're getting rid of those crazy leftists. You know, to me, that's a recipe for disaster. But I have wondered for quite some time over the past 25, 30 years, I have wondered how they were going to get those people who call themselves Christian conservatives to go along with the destruction of the country. And this, to me, is the perfect example. This is how you get people to say, okay, well, I know it's probably not right, but it's better than what they're doing. There is no better recipe for disaster than to assume that role. And I think we're headed there. I'm not saying that I can fix it. I know I can't fix it. But I think that's exactly what's going to happen. How do you get the people who actually stand for right and what's good to violate their own principles? How do you do that? That is a monumental task to get people who say they stand for something to agree that they will no longer stand for it to accomplish another goal. And that's exactly where I think we are. And I think I have been primed for it. I think we've been set up for it. It's one of the greatest psyops in the history of man. But we have prepared.
I keep calling it a perfect storm. It is.
Yes.
It's an absolutely perfect storm.
But we have prepared this, and one of the things that I've wondered about, and I still wonder about this, and I'm still trying to figure out in my mind, and of course I can be wrong. Hope I am. I'll never hope I'm right about any of this. But the thing that I'm trying to figure out is how does mandatory vaccinations fit into this? How? Because I truly believe, and again, you know, it's my opinion, I sell it for what it's worth, but I truly believe in my heart of hearts that this vaccination is destined as a population control. I do believe that the people who take this vaccine, many of them will be sterilized. I believe that is part and parcel of this. And I also believe that this will also just within a course of time, and it may be binary. You may have to take another one somewhere else that makes the whole thing work. but I believe it's a great way to get rid of what the socialists call useless eaters. In other words, the older folks who no longer work. And I realize this sounds like a science fiction movie.
From what I'm hearing from people who have studied the subject, there's a couple out there that did an interview with Sean at SGT Report here in the last week, who have extensively studied it, and they're looking at the hydrogel, which is what contains the tracking, the tracking devices, the nano particles that they can basically do all sorts of things with it, including the sterilization. But they're also putting it not just in vaccines, but they're apparently looking at putting it in some processed foods. But this hydrogel, supposedly, from what I understand, makes you an antenna for 5G.
I would not be surprised at that at all, Terry. Right now, I'll be honest with you, there's nothing this government could do that would surprise me except turn honest. That's the only thing that would truly surprise me, is if they did something that was honest and humanly thing I can see. And my good friend in Colorado just made a point, and I agree with him wholeheartedly. Thanks, George. He also said that this is also about money control, and I agree with that. I even had another good friend from Colorado who is a friend of ours, Wendy, who's in Idaho now, she and I were talking today by text, and she said, what if, and this is a possibility, what if they told everyone who is on Social Security, if you don't take the vaccine, you do not get your money? Now, my wife and I were talking about that today, and she said, well, that wouldn't be right because it's your money. And I said, what does this government do that's right? You think it would bother them to steal your money? They've been doing it for their entire existence. They've been stealing your money your entire life. Why do you think it would bother them now? And I also think, and thanks, George, appreciate this. Hope you and your beautiful bride are well. But I also think about this, too, is, here was something everybody forgot about that the Senate Committee on Finance came up with. And I think this is going to come to play here somewhere, because it was created and then it sat there unused. And that is always something to worry about. And it was a piece of legislation that was prepared by the Democrats in the Senate, and it was called Wealth as Wages, to provide a way for the federal government to latch on to IRAs and 401ks. Now, there's $28 trillion in this country in IRAs and 401ks. Now, can you imagine the drooling that is going on by people in this government over $28 trillion sitting somewhere that they might could put their hands on? And they
What happens when people have nothing to lose?
Well, we know what happens. That's what I made the statement to a gentleman today, also from Colorado, on a phone call, when I told him, there is no record in history of comfortable people ever revolting. Now, I'm going to get into one of my radio shows. I'm not exactly sure when I put it all together, but I believe that the international bankers in the end fail. I believe this entire program, everything they've planned and worked for, I believe it fails. And again, I'm working on putting that together, just as I, kind of laid out what I believe was happening. But I believe ultimately it fails. And it's either going to happen the way that I think that I'm putting it together. It's either going to be that or divine intervention. Because I realize this country has turned godless over the years, and I believe that
the prophecies say that there be divine intervention, but that requires that the existence on this earth as we know it to come to an end.
Right. I think life as we know it is about to come to an end in this country, Terry. This flatten the curve, this new normal. I don't think any of this is going back country we grew up in. And I always think of, God rest his soul, I always think of Merle Haggard and his song, America, Where Did You Go? And a member of his band at the end of the song before the last chorus, and he said, well, Merle, I think she's gone. And I remember hearing that song, riding my motorcycle through the beautiful mountains of Colorado, and I remember hearing that song on my headphones. And I thought, oh, my, did he hit it right there? America, where did you go? Hey, Merle, I believe she's gone. And, of course, I had written that I thought she was gone 20 years ago. And I once made the analogy that America is that deer that has been shot through the heart, still running because he doesn't know he's dead yet. And I believe that was America 25, 30 years ago. And this is just the culmination now of where we're going. You know, I wish I had some good news for you folks, but reality is reality, and that's what we have to deal with. I mean, we can sit around and wish and hope, and I think I did a meme this week, and I said, how many people are suffering from opioid addiction? And, yes, we want to hope. But hope is not a method. Hope is not a force multiplier. And as Patrick Henry said, we will listen to that siren song of hope until we are all turned into beasts. Look around you, people. How are the people reacting? Have you ever seen people this nutty in your life? It's absolutely unconscionable on so many levels, Terry.
Well, why people believe that a screen door in a submarine is going to be of any value is a surprise to me. It's unbelievable to me how people have no scientific knowledge whatsoever and believe the lies that they're being told. It just blows me away every day.
I did some exploration on that, and that was a question I was trying to answer for myself, and my wife had told me 20 some years ago, she was an educator for 30 years, and she told me several years ago that most Americans never get out of the concrete stage of mental development. I got really interested in that because I have talked to people. And you provide them with facts. And a good friend of mine up in Northwest Arizona, Arkansas, he and I have talked about this many times. Terry, you and I have talked about this. How can you present so many facts to people, irrefutable facts that you can present, and they look at them and go, no, I still don't believe it. You know, and so the concrete stage of mental development is interesting because it's usually at the age group of 7 to 11 to 13, somewhere in that age group. That is the concrete stage of mental development. And I agree with my wife. Most adults never got out of the concrete stage of mental development, and the public school systems are responsible for that. One of the things to help people understand that is you have inductive reasoning, which people in the concrete stage, they have that inductive reasoning. And it was best explained to me of this way, inductive reasoning. Okay, A equals B and B equals C. But you have in the concrete stage, you have inductive reasoning, but you do not have deductive reasoning. You have to get out of the concrete stage to have deductive reasoning. And if you want to explain that again better, it's A equals B, B equals C, but deductive reasoning is A also equals C. Cannot do that. And this friend of mine, we were talking about how can you look at 9/11? How can you look at World Trade Center building number 7, where you can actually see, watch it in slow motion, you can actually see the explosion start in the penthouse on that building. And it wasn't hit by any plane. It wasn't hit by anything. And you can sit and watch that building fall straight down into its own footprint. And you can tell people that had to be from an internal explosion, and they go A equals B, B equals C, but they cannot see A equals C also. They cannot do the deductive reasoning that, hey, there is no way that building fell the way the government said it did. It's impossible. Their mind around it, and there's also the other thing, is that comfort level. They do not want to wrap their mind around it.
Well, there's another factor to this. There's another factor to this, though.
Okay. Go ahead.
These people who I have always referred to them as syllogistically challenged. They can listen to somebody who says things that sound like it might be logical, but really isn't, because there's a syllogistic disconnect in what they're saying. But because it sounds attractive, they accept it.
Well, one of the ways I agree with that. And the other way, the other analogy I've made is the fact of how many times have you been having, and I don't mean you, this is a general question. How many times have you been having a really, really pleasant dream and you get angry if someone wakes you up? Well, this thing that you believe is true, the thing about the Constitution being divinely inspired, the thing about the government is going to protect your rights, all of these things is a dream that you are having. And the last thing you want is for someone to splash reality in your face and wake you up. You would much prefer to stay asleep and to go right through the dream. And that describes the great majority of the American citizenry in this country. And it's just amazing to me over and over again that you can provide facts to people and they go, yeah, well, that may be true, but I don't like that. And I liken that to the debate I had in, I think it was 1999 in Sacramento, California, when I had the debate with the German mathematician on gun control. And we were debating the issue, and finally she said at the end of nearing the end of our debate, I was getting exasperated, and every time she made a point, I countered it about her violence and, you know, all of these other things, and I brought up statistics. And finally this lady who had a PhD in mathematics made this statement. She said, I don't care how many facts you have, you are not going to change my mind. Stop and think about that, people. I don't care how many facts you have, you are not going to change my mind. That today is about 310 million American citizens. There's 330 million.
At least she was honest about it.
Well, she was. And, you know, and the thing of it was, is I looked at her and I said, did you hear what you just said? And she said, yes. And I said, how do you equate that to the field of mathematics? I said, mathematics is intellectual. Your position is emotional. Never the twain shall meet. But she still never agreed with me, and she wasn't going to. Americans make 98.9% of their decisions based on emotion, not intellect. And if you watch the 24-hour news cycle, what is played to on every page of that news, your emotional state.
Well,
that's
I have to say something.
Please do.
First of all, I know that you agree that we are in a great spiritual battle. Everything going on is a part of the spiritual battle. Scripture tells us that it's not up to us to make a decision for the other people. It basically says that if we show them the right path and they don't take it, their blood is on their hands and not ours. But if we don't show them the right path, if we show them the wrong path or cause them to stumble or fail to show them the right path, then their blood is on our hands.
Well,
so that woman, you did what you could do, and now you have to shake the dust off of your feet, off your sandals, and move on. People like that are not our responsibility. We can tell them what's right. We can show them what's right. But if they're not willing to listen to that, then it's their problem. We don't need to feel guilty about that. We need to find the people whose ears can hear, and they're willing to understand the truth and accept it and act upon it. That's who I'm looking for. I recognize it that less than 1 out of 10, this is a real statistic that was actually done by a research institute or somebody like that back around 1990. They found that only 1 out of 10 people, and they were really actually analyzing Christian men, and they found that only 1 out of 10 would make a positive change in their life if they heard a truth, and that 80%,
one out of 10 now,
it may be 1 out of 10 will never make a change no matter what, and 80% will only make a positive change in the context of a relationship. So it is a burden upon us to build those relationships, because that's the only way the real positive change is going to happen. And I've got people today who I've built relationships with over the years who have told me, Terry, I used to think you were just paranoid, and now I recognize that what you were trying to tell me 10 years ago was absolutely true. But it's only because that they had a relationship that started them to actually be able to accept things and make that change.
Well, Terry, I don't have any feelings, bad feelings about what I've done. I don't feel bad about that. I feel bad about maybe I haven't done enough. That is the point that drives me, is every day I don't think I've done enough, because I think there's someone out there, and that goes back to Isaiah and the remnant. There may be someone out I don't even know about. Someone may be listening to this tonight, may hear us both, and they may think that both of us should be in the funny farm, but there may be something in their lives that happened to them in the next few days, next few months, or the next few years that will change them. And my job is to plant the seeds. I'm not supposed to see the crop come to fruit. My job is to plant the seed and to get people to at least see that it was there. And as Isaiah and the remnant, it's not important that I know who they are. And I understand that, but I totally agree with your relationship, because I can tell you about, quite a few people just recently, some wonderful people that I still have a relationship with in Arkansas, and there were people in Colorado like George, and I love you, George, and Chrissy, and they, I had relationships with them. I talked with a minister there that I had a relationship with, and it made a difference. And a couple of guys who are just leaving county commissioner positions in Arkansas that I've talked to this week. And they both were in office for 8 years, and I helped both of them work very hard to help both of them get elected. And they're both independents. They're not with either party. But and those are important relationships, Terry. So I totally understand what you're saying. But I believe that, you know, we can't stop trying. And boy, do I get to, I've had a couple of things that happened this week that just, you know, kick my chair out from under me. But I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep going. And that because
we got
that's
about
my job.
We got about 2 minutes. Is there one of those stories you want to tell us?
Well, happened this week? Well, the one that bothered me was the lady I've known for such a long time and who has been reading my stuff forever and, you know, forever, not that long, but, you know, at least probably 8-10 years. But she just, in my mind, she just went off. She was upset at me because I didn't realize how important Trump was and that he was the savior and that if I didn't get behind him, and I was kind of floored. She has swallowed the pill, and she's the one who told me, and it really hurt me, you know, to see that relationship have that kind of, I won't call it an ending, but at least that kind of a chapter ending of where she said, when she told me, and I was just floored, she said, I think Trump should be allowed to violate the Constitution all he wants to, because the left wing, the liberals have been doing it for years. I don't see why he can't do it too. And the rationale of that from a mature, intelligent woman just blew me away. I'm sorry it affected me for 2 days.
Well, the question that I have to that, and we don't have time to get into it, but maybe it's something we need to talk about, is why can he not deal with the situation within his constitutional limits?
Well, that would be my point too. But here was the other thing, is I said, okay, if he is this, why has he put all of these deep state people into his cabinet?
Right.
I mean, some of the worst deep state people, Pompeo, Barr, all of these people nominating Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. Where in the world did that come from?
I'm afraid we're going to have to end on that, Mike. We are out of time, my friend. Serious consideration.
Always great, Terry.
Thanks very much, Mike. We'll be back next Thursday night with Handling the Truth. Thanks for listening tonight, everyone.
Thanks, buddy. Take care.
Good night.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing, hallelujah.
Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to the kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair.